Good afternoon, Council. Ready to proceed?
May it please the Court, I'm Edward McNally from the Morris James Firm, representing the North American Catholic Educational Programming Foundation, which I will mercifully refer to as NACEF, save myself some time. Many years ago, I represented a large bank attempting to collect a fair amount of money from a manufacturing concern that was going broke. The directors took the last $100,000 and spent it in Atlantic City. Now, my friends on the other side would say that that was a legitimate attempt to enhance enterprise value, and therefore okay. But I hope we can agree today that there is a fiduciary duty of some sort owed by directors of an insolvent corporation to its creditors. Now, I suggest that the duty is limited. Certainly it depends upon insolvency. Certainly it should incorporate an element of self-dealing. And by self-dealing, I mean acting on behalf of a creditor, a large creditor that controls the directors, which we say, by the way, is the case here. And certainly it ought to have an element of bad conduct, such as not carrying out the corporation's business in a deliberate fashion, much like the directors I describe who went to Atlantic City.
Well, that would be a derivative claim, wouldn't it, for the stockholders?
The circumstance I described would be derivative, Justice Ridgway. It would be. But my point is there's still a duty.
Okay. And the reason it's a derivative claim is because the damage is to the corporation or the enterprise.
Or in the words of Tooley, that's who the judgment gets paid to. In this case, we would have to satisfy the Tooley test, and the judgment should be paid to NACEF. We say, if we prevail, that's what we say, it's a direct claim. But I was speaking solely about the duty, whether it's derivative or direct, and how it's asserted either way. Now, here, we think that
there's really... Let me make sure I understand your point. You're using Tooley to argue in that this otherwise derivative claim should be direct because your client is the only entity available to receive the money.
Not quite. I am arguing that Tooley supports characterizing this claim as a direct one because the harm that was incurred here is peculiar to my client, and it would be my client who would recover the sums that are due for the wrongful, we'd say, taking of our licenses. And it was us and us alone who suffered that harm, and it's us and us alone who should receive the judgment.
But you're contending your client's a creditor, and you would agree your client would be one of many creditors. Is that right?
Yes. But it's the only creditor. In the weird circumstance, you will recall that, as the complaint alleged, the other major creditors were the other companies that owned Spectrum. They got bought out. And so they're out of the picture, leaving just NASA.
I'd like to ask you to comment on this scenario and tell me if you believe this is right or wrong. The reason creditors are given standing to sue as a company becomes insolvent is because the stockholders otherwise would not, and that they are going to be the beneficiaries ultimately of the corporation recovering what it is due to it, and the fiduciary duties are owed to the company. So why isn't this just merely a matter of standing? The creditors have the authority to bring the action for breach of fiduciary duty owed to the corporation as opposed to any fiduciary duty to outside parties.
Well, this, of course, was not brought as a derivative suit, deliberately so. Under the circumstances, Justice Ridgway, the way you describe it, that is the justification for conferring standing on creditors to bring a derivative suit. I agree with that. We say also that creditors have standing to bring a direct action under the peculiar circumstances that are perhaps in some respects described in the production resources case, for example, when there is a direct harm to a specific creditor and that creditor is the one that's damaged, and that creditor should be able to recover. In this case, if there is a damage award, it won't go to the corporation. It will go to NACEF. And that's just not a function of how the case was brought. It's a function of the claim, because NACEF is the one that was hurt. not the corporation.
Is it correct that the vice chancellor found that NACEF did not show a clear entitlement to payment?
Correct.
Which he found to be a prerequisite to asserting a direct claim for director's breach of fiduciary duty?
Yes.
How did he err in coming to that conclusion?
In several respects. Number one, the standard that he adopted, the clear and immediately due standard, is a pleading rule. It's not found in the rules and therefore should not have been imposed on the plaintiff in this case. There's no rule of chancery that says you have to plead clear and immediately due status as a creditor. Secondly, he erred because he did not construe the complaint with the liberality that's required in dealing with a motion to dismiss. We never got our shot at proving our case. We were cut off at the pleading stage. Now, that's just not an academic point because of the way this case was brought on. The way the case was brought on also included a motion to dismiss for jurisdictional grounds. And that permitted people to file affidavits. So it is clear from the affidavits, the court can rest assured, that NACEF is a creditor. NACEF is described as a creditor in the defendant's own papers.
Well, isn't the clear claim to entitlement related to the fact that creditors have contractual basis for asserting their claims or other means to perfect their claims?
Certainly creditors do exactly what you have just said. They have a means to assert a contract claim. Of course, in the context of insolvency, a contract claim is worthless for the most part. Obviously, there are some residual assets that may be spread among the creditors. But
isn't there a sense that in the original documents that set out the creditor's claim and the debtor's obligation that there are protective mechanisms that are bargained for? And then absent being able to negotiate the best possible deal, when the debtor becomes insolvent, traditionally, we don't look to the debtor's claim during the zone of insolvency as one, unless it's absolutely a clear entitlement under the circumstances, it can be asserted as a direct claim against directors for breach of fiduciary duty. Is there something wrong with that analysis?
I think so.
To begin with, other than the fact it's not as articulately stated as it might be.
There are a couple of points that lurk in your question, Chief Justice, and these are critical points, so I want to really focus on them. The first point is that somehow creditors in some way can protect themselves by their contractual documents that will cover everything that could possibly happen. Now, I want to emphasize that this case is not a breach of contract case. I readily concede that directors have no liability when their corporation breaches the contract. Otherwise, we wouldn't have corporate entities. It wouldn't make any sense. There wouldn't be protection for directors. That's not this case. What this case is a claim that the contract, in effect, didn't deal with this situation. Now, when you go back to what contracts do and do not deal with, there's an interesting comment in the Big Lots case. There, the vice chancellor adopted something of the theory that Your Honor just articulated, which is, you know, creditors are big boys, they ought to go ahead and protect themselves. Of course, we all know that most creditors aren't big institutions. And they should protect themselves because they can get, as the vice chancellor said, covenants that often bind debt contracts. That's his phrase on page 7. In some cases, the parties could negotiate for something that would protect themselves. That's not this case. What happened here was never envisioned by any of the parties. They didn't negotiate it, contract for it. Now, I will say that there is always the possibility in a contract of protecting yourself. All you have to do is have all the consideration put in an escrow. And this is a real-world problem. People don't do that in contracts. They don't negotiate contracts that way. They don't provide for that kind of protection. Here we say it's important as a matter of policy to protect creditors' rights. When they haven't contracted for a particular provision because nobody's thought about it, it's important because if you don't do that, if you don't, in a sense, fill in the gaps, then the negotiation of any significant commercial transaction will have not the 65 pages that were involved here, but 565 pages.
Why isn't that covered by the implied covenant of good faith and fair deal? Why doesn't that fill in the gaps?
It fills in the gaps. It may fill. That's, of course, a very hard covenant to effectively recover under, even under our law. We always talk about it, but nobody does anything about it. It's like the weather. The fact of the matter is it helps people, I suppose, when they have contract claims. But I don't really see that theory as being extended to the duty of a board of directors to not, in effect, do something completely outside the contract rights and to do something that we say specifically hurt a particular creditor and did not, this is a key point, advance the legitimate interests of the company. Therefore, we say that really doesn't apply here. It doesn't help. It's like the other point that people sometimes make, which is rely on fraudulent conveyance law. Fraudulent conveyance law doesn't apply in a case like this. These directors did not get money from Clearwire. They didn't convey anything to themselves. It doesn't help. There is no remedy unless we provide them with a remedy, which we say is cut off here at the pleading stage in a way that it should not have been. Now, the other point is that maybe creditors should go and assert their contract claim. That is, they should sue. NASEF should have sued in Superior Court to get a judgment. Then it would have been just like the plaintiff in the production resources case. Problem with that is it's not geared to the real world. In the real world, creditors don't sue insolvent corporations for purposes of getting a meaningless judgment that they cannot enforce. That just doesn't happen. It's a barrier to the assertion of creditors' rights, which I asked this court not to impose. Now, finally, I hope I've tried to address your questions, Chief Justice. If I haven't, I'm sorry. Finally, I want to make it clear that certainly NASEF was a creditor. Perhaps the easiest way to understand that is to look at the defendant's own document. What I find most useful in that respect is the description of the transaction that is contained in a summary, which is in the appendix, of course, at page A367, 368. I guess the document really begins at 366, where they summarize the deal. As they point out on page 368, each time an individual use agreement is executed, Clearwire owes money to NASEF. In fact, that's what happened here. NASEF was paid money. The documents attached to Mr. Primo's affidavit show that, indeed, the defendants, Clearwire admits in December of 2001 that it owes almost $6 million the next month to NASEF. So the real bad result here, I think, is that the pleading standard that was imposed, which we say was a new standard, and which, quite frankly, perhaps I should have anticipated, but I didn't, we say was, in effect, cut off a valid claim that the court realized was a valid claim but could not find within the four corners of the complaint. Now, the complaint says NASEF's a creditor. Make no mistake about that. That fact is pled in the complaint. The complaint pleads facts to show why NASEF is a creditor. I did not plead that there was a clear and immediate debt due in the complaint. And I think it's fair to say that at least until Big Lots came along and used that kind of language, and we think stretched the holding of production resources to require that kind of status, that that was unheard of in Delaware law until this case was decided.
I'm sorry to ask such a fundamental and elemental question, but tell me, what is the source of the fiduciary duty to a creditor as opposed to the corporate enterprise?
The source of the fiduciary duty lies in the relationship that existed in this case between NASEF, who had valuable assets, who placed those assets in the control of these defendants, who had control over their license rights, and proceeded to abuse that control. Now, it's not a trust in the classical sense. It's not even a corporate fiduciary duty in the classical sense. But it is a duty that we say, this court should say, directors have when a company becomes insolvent, because then the stockholders have no interest, and the only person that the directors are really acting for are its creditors. It's the situation that you described at the beginning. It's an elementary question, but it's a critical question. It's the question. So there is such a duty. And if without that duty, where are we? Stockholders won't enforce their rights because the company's insolvent. That means directors have no one to account to, no matter how much assets they might manage. There's no one to account to. There has to be that duty.
Well, isn't fiduciary duty, doesn't it derive from a special relationship? And you're saying, as I understand it, Ben, that being a creditor is a special relationship. That imposes the fiduciary duty.
Upon insolvency. And I'm not saying in normal course. Upon insolvency, the stockholders have lost their interest. At that point, the directors are acting for the creditors. When that occurs, our law has long recognized such a duty exists. I mean, it goes back to the 30s, I think. And there's a whole bunch of cases there. In the footnote, I guess it's 86 of the production resources, to talk about that duty and how it derives and cases that upheld that duty. We'll skip over a couple of other things for the sake of time, but let me just add one further observation in response to Justice Ridgely's point. The quote of Justice Frankfurt that's set forth in Judge Vice Chancellor Strine's opinion, it's an interesting quote, says to speak of a person as a fiduciary really just begins the analysis, does not end the analysis. The question is, to whom is he a fiduciary? What is the extent of those duties? We believe in this case that had we been permitted to get discovery, we would have been able to show that these directors acted for the purpose of preserving as best they could whatever value there might have existed for another creditor, their employer, Goldman Sachs. We believe that we will show that they knew that they could not possibly fulfill the company would not fulfill its obligations to NASEP. They knew that NASEP was going to be hurt by that and hurt badly. But they didn't care, even when the company was insolvent. We think that under those circumstances, when they were not just this wasn't just a normal creditor relationship, it had an element of a more typical fiduciary relationship in the sense that they were in control of our assets, which is the classic case of a fiduciary, a person who manages someone else's assets for the benefit of that other person. This is very, very close to that. That's why we say this case should have proceeded. Now, I have just a couple of more minutes, and I want to talk about what I think is the hardest part of my argument, which is the zone of insolvency argument. Clearly, this is a concept that a lot of people talk about, and it's a little hard to define. We believe, of course we understand it in this case, but the Court of Chancery said there are no such claims. That is, creditors have no direct claims, period, when a company is in the zone of insolvency. That's a significant holding. It effectively cuts off any such actions and leaves the directors in that situation accountable, if they're accountable to anyone, to the stockholders, I suppose, if there's enough value in the company at the end of the day to make anybody care. We say that the zone of insolvency begins when normal operating results show that the company at some point in the future, under the company's own predictions, it will not be able to cover its maturing debts. That was precisely the situation here. Certainly, we know from the company's own financial statements, their auditors said that they were probably not going to make it. We know from their own cash projections that they were projected to be out of cash. If there's any case where they were in the zone of insolvency, if not insolvent, that's this case. I think I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may, please.
All right. Thank you.
Chief Justice Steele, Justices, Judge Abelman, the dismissal of the complaint by the court below was correct, and this court ought to affirm it. I propose, subject to the court's pleasure, to suggest that the court can affirm the dismissal of the complaint without reaching the broader doctrinal issues that the appellant is seeking Your Honor's judicial pronouncement upon. But I propose then, after discussing that, to address those broader doctrinal issues in case the court decides to address those in resolving this appeal. And when we get to those issues, I will show that it would damage the fabric of our law, it would damage the credibility of our law, and it would damage the utility of our law to adopt the changes for which the appellant advocates. Let me turn to the first point. Plaintiff's claim of jurisdiction and plaintiff's underlying claim on the merits depend entirely on the assertion that if Clearwire became insolvent or entered the zone of insolvency, then the fiduciary duties of Clearwire's directors shifted from promotion of stockholder and corporate interests to the promotion of plaintiff's interests as a creditor, and not just creditor's interest generally, but this plaintiff's individualized interest as an individual creditor, a direct claim, not a derivative one. That theory is wrong, as I will argue later. But even on that theory, it's immediately apparent that there are three elements to it that the plaintiff must meet. The first is that the plaintiff must be a creditor, and I will challenge that. The second is insolvency status, and I will challenge that. And the third, and it's third not by reason of lesser importance, but by happenstance really of how the argument is organized, is that the plaintiff has to show an action by the fiduciaries that would constitute some kind of a breach. Plaintiff has got problems on all three of those elements. In the first place, it isn't a creditor. It does not assert that it is owed any money. Count two, of course, is the count of the complaint that we're really talking about here, because that's what jurisdiction is premised on, and that's the fiduciary duty count. And it doesn't assert that the plaintiff is owed any money. We heard today that NASEF says, well, it was owed money under the master agreement whenever there was an individual use agreement that was entered into. But the complaint says nothing about having not been paid money. Nothing. It doesn't complain that there was ever any breach of the master agreement either, or that under that agreement NASEF is entitled to some performance in exchange for performance it gave. Plaintiff once filed a breach of contract suit against Clearwire, but it withdrew that suit voluntarily. Now, plaintiff, therefore, isn't a creditor really in any sense of the world. It is a contractual counterparty, and that's all it is. Now, this court has previously considered what a creditor is in the context of creditor protection in insolvency.
Well, so, on the complaint aspect.
Yes, Your Honor.
The other side says that the complaint alleges that NASEF was a creditor. Therefore, that's enough. Why isn't that enough?
Well, Your Honor, today is the venerable birthday of Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln once asked the question, if you call a dog's tail a leg, how many legs does the dog have? The answer, of course, is still only four, because the tail is a tail, whatever you call it. The complaint fails to allege any fact which the court below could take as true or from which it could draw a reasonable inference establishing creditor status. So calling yourself a creditor, saying I'm a substantial creditor, doesn't make it so. I think that's a complete answer to Your Honor's question, but if not.
So notice pleading is not enough on that issue.
Well, I think notice pleading under the cases under Chancery Court Rule 12b-6 is pleading of facts that put a defendant on notice of the claim. The court below was not required to take rhetoric as true, but factual allegations as true. There were no facts in the complaint that established creditor status. There was no claim of breach of the master agreement. The only claim in the complaint was that NASEF was a counterparty, on the one hand, to Clearwire, on the other hand, in the master agreement. And that does not establish creditor status.
Mr. Nolan, I probably should have asked Mr. McNally this question, and by asking you, I guess he might answer it when he gets up again. But he mentioned that his client placed licenses in the context of the creation of a fiduciary relationship with the directors in the hands of the corporation that they managed. Does that create any obligation to manage those licenses in such a way that it returns profit to his client that would make his client a creditor?
I think the answer is no, and I think the premise for the question is incorrect. The master agreement provided for Clearwire to have the right to acquire licenses to certain frequency when that frequency became available came out from under licenses that NASEF had already granted to others. The issue in this case is not one of whether the licenses were being misused. The question is, I think, more whether the licenses would be purchased under the master agreement. So I don't believe that the premise of the question is accurate. Now, as to the hypothetical question of what would happen if I rented Mr. McNally's license to do something, I'm not sure that carries with it a particular fiduciary obligation. I certainly know of none, and it isn't an obligation that was alleged in this complaint as part of what is being claimed. Now, but I want to return, because I think it's important, to the point of what a creditor means in this context. Now, I'll do it very briefly in an abbreviated way, but this court, Section 174 of the General Corporation Law, provides standing to creditors, using that term, to sue for recovery of illegally paid dividends or amounts paid out to repurchase shares when the company is insolvent. That is, insolvency under the statute triggers a right of creditors to then sue for the return of those illegal dividends or redemptions. In Johnston against Wolf, this court was faced with the question of what does the word creditor mean? And the court held that creditor meant judgment creditor. Only a person having a judgment when the wrong occurred could sue to get the illegal dividend back. I submit that the same should apply here. The context is certainly similar. The question of primacy as between stockholder interests and creditor interests. Consistency is good. I think we should strive to make our common law consistent with our statutory law.
And are you saying that being a judgment creditor is consistent with the rule that would require clear entitlement to payment?
I think being a judgment creditor gets you very, very much closer to having a clear entitlement to payment, and it may get you 100% there, yes.
It would have to be a final judgment.
It would have to be a final judgment. And if it were a final judgment, then I would say you had a clear entitlement to payment. I would say that's right, because then you're not operating in the realm of hypotheticals. You're operating in the realm of settled legal rights. The second factor that I mentioned was insolvency. Clearwire was not insolvent or in some zone of insolvency. The insolvency standard is reasonably clear in our law, although it's often very difficult to apply to facts. It means either balance sheet insolvency, assets are less than liabilities, or an inability to pay debts as they come due. Certainly the complaint never established or alleged insolvency other than using the talismanic term insolvent. The only factual allegations comparing assets to liabilities in the complaint were in paragraph 30 of the complaint, which showed a $5 million excess of assets over even future liabilities, as opposed to the opposite. And the complaint nowhere alleged any failure to pay debts as they came due. Did not even allege a failure to pay NASEF, a debt that was due. The affidavits likewise consistently showed positive stockholders' equity. The balance sheets showed substantial stockholders' equity at the end of every period. And perhaps that is why the court below failed to cite to any provision of the complaint as the basis for an inference of insolvency. Simply no citation in the opinion to the complaint for that. But Clearwire wasn't in some zone of insolvency either. The fogginess of that concept is, I suggest, illustrated by the fact that our cases, our judges, our courts have not even been able to settle on a single word to describe the concept. It's been variously called the zone of insolvency, the vicinity of insolvency, the lip of insolvency, the brink of insolvency, each of those words carrying a different nuance. But we aren't and can't be ruled by the length of the chancellor's foot or the extent of his vocabulary when it comes time for directors to consider to whom their loyalty is to be directed. I submit that for the concept to have any meaning, or any utility, it has to be limited to the indisputable fact of ineluctable eventual insolvency in fact.
So, as I understand your brief, you would draw two bright lines. The directors have no fiduciary duties to creditors unless there's this unequivocal insolvency, and even then, it would be a derivative action, not direct.
That's right. That is absolutely correct.
And that's what the vice chancellor held.
The vice chancellor did hold that it would have to be that there was no direct claim in the vicinity of insolvency, but he suggested that there could be a direct claim in an insolvency in fact, a claim for breach of fiduciary duty for insolvency in fact.
Mr. Nolan, this court were to affirm the vice chancellor's decision, can the other two counts be refiled? Can the plaintiffs refile for relief in the Superior Court, or have they foreclosed that possibility because of the original lawsuit?
Well, I think that...
I guess what I'm asking is, are they going to be without a remedy altogether?
Well, I would hesitate to say that NACEF ever considers itself to be without a remedy. It's filed a lawsuit in the Rhode Island Federal District Court asserting these very same claims, but characterizing them slightly differently. And that is in our appendix. So I suppose that will be a question for the Rhode Island Court. Thinking forward hypothetically, I suppose that if it had jurisdiction over the individuals, it might be able to file counts 1 and 3 wherever it has that jurisdiction. It does not have that jurisdiction here.
So they were asserting these claims on this basis primarily to take advantage of the statute Delaware has that would have provided jurisdiction. And the question may be, can they file suit in another state other than Delaware on those two counts?
Yes, that's now perhaps they've allowed the statute of limitations to expire, or there may be some other difficulty, but they could have found out where the defendants are and filed counts 1 and 3 against the defendants where they are, rather than trying to hijack Section 3114 to bring those other two counts in. Let me turn, unless the court has further questions on insolvency, because I see time is clicking away, to the third element. That is, was there a duty of some kind that could be considered as having been breached? Not only, as I said, was plaintiff not a creditor and Clearwire not insolvent, but they had to show that there was some such duty.
Maybe I took my notes wrong, Mr. Nolan, but I thought your third point was the complaint failed to allege any direct or action that would constitute a breach. But you're now arguing the third point is they didn't allege a duty that was owed?
No. Your Honor's notes are absolutely correct, but I may have put the emphasis on the wrong syllable. The question is, is it possible in any circumstance for what the directors did to be considered a breach of some duty? Remember, what the directors did is they allegedly failed to give away, to relinquish Clearwire's contractual rights under the master agreement back to NACEF. Now, that's what the plaintiff contends they had a fiduciary duty to do, to decide that this business is done for, and therefore we're going to give all our contract rights back to NACEF and free it from the contract. But relinquishing assets for no consideration with no contractual obligation is what we call gift or waste. It's not a fiduciary duty. It is a fiduciary breach to give away those assets. So even if you just cabinet to that and say, okay, what is it the defendants did that is supposedly a breach of fiduciary duty? What they did is they allegedly failed to give up contractual rights of Clearwire. And the venality that is alleged in failing to do that is that they attempted to keep Clearwire in business. rather than simply saying, game over, you know, come in, pick the bones. So the court, I think, can affirm on that basis without reaching the broader doctrinal issues that we've discussed. And if I can just turn briefly, though, to those issues, because I think it's important in light of the colloquy with my friend that you've had. The plaintiff argues, again, that when a corporation has entered a zone of insolvency, the corporation's directors owe fiduciary duties to corporate creditors, and that those creditors can assert direct, non-derivative claims against the directors for not promoting the creditors' interests over those of the stockholders. And, of course, that's what the court below said could not be done. There certainly has been legitimate debate, both judicially and academically, about whether, as a corporation slides toward insolvency, directors ought to consider creditor interests and employee interests and community interests and all sorts of other forms of interest as well, along with stockholder interests, in deciding what course the corporation should take. And there's likewise been debate about whether and when creditors obtain standing to assert derivative claims on behalf of the corporation itself, to recover value for the corporation and all those having an interest in it. But that's not this case. As some of the court's questions have revealed, what we're talking about here is a claim that directors of Clearwire owed NASAF individually a fiduciary duty that required them to abandon Clearwire's contract rights under the master agreements for the benefit of NASAF, for NASAF's individual benefit and its individual profit. That claim is wildly out of the mainstream and radically wide of the academic debate that is going on, because it would elevate a creditor's rights above those of the stockholders and the corporation and force the directors to act for the individual benefit of a single creditor, regardless of, and indeed contrary to, the interests of the corporation itself. Our law doesn't do that. It doesn't require that, and it doesn't do it for good reasons. First, it would create impossible conflicts. An individualized duty to one creditor implies the right to act adversely to all other creditors, and indeed to the stockholders themselves. But each creditor would have an equal competing right to the director's loyalty, and would presumably, that loyalty would presumably still also be owed in some measure to the stockholders. So, taking NASAF's claim as an example, the duty to maximize NASAF's welfare by relinquishing the corporation's rights under the master agreement would be in direct conflict with the duty of the directors to hold on to those rights for the benefit of other creditors by keeping Clearwire in business and perhaps staying out of insolvency. Second, it would create economic inefficiencies. As pointed out in the Credit DNA case, and in many of the academic articles, the economic objectives of stockholders and creditors are different from one another. Creditors set the hurdle low. They just want the corporation to take enough risk and to do well enough to pay off their debt. Stockholders set that hurdle higher. They want the corporation to pay off the debt and then provide a return on their investment. Forcing the hurdle to be set low is economically inefficient. It disincentivizes wealth creation. Third, shifting fiduciary duties to creditors limits or eliminates the director's ability to negotiate with creditors for accommodations that might benefit the firm. After all, particularly in the zone of insolvency, but also in insolvency, if directors have the ability to negotiate for accommodation, they might be able to stretch out obligations or to get concessions on obligations that allow the business to come out of insolvency. I was looking at this morning's Wall Street Journal. There's an article on page C something, the back section of section C. And in that, an author goes through and analyzes the financial condition of Ford Motor Company and concludes, based on its assets, its liabilities, its pension liabilities, all sorts of other liabilities, the likely return from its car business, that the value of a share of Ford Motor stock the rational value today is exactly zero. Does that mean that now the Ford directors should say, game up, looks pretty bad for us, you know, we'll just close up the company and sell the assets? No, it obviously doesn't. It obviously doesn't do that. Fourth, given the ambiguity of where the zone lies, directors would often be forced to guess whether a company was in the zone of insolvency or not, and therefore to guess to whom their duties ran from time to time. And if they guessed wrong, then presumably they would have liability for breaching their duties to the inadvertently disfavored constituency. We can't put directors in such a position, or we won't have directors.
Could I interrupt for a second here?
Yes, ma'am.
In your argument, you're essentially concluding what the facts will determine or would determine if this case were allowed to go any farther. And let's assume that a lot of the concerns that you've expressed in terms of the impact of decisions, maybe those concerns are valid if you've got a situation where directors are not really in a zone of insolvency, and here's why they felt that the company could continue to get itself out of this hole and prosper in the future. But that would be something that would be determined as a factual matter, and if the facts clearly established that, no, this company was going under and that the directors knew it was going under and that the directors were taking steps that were not in the best interests of any of the creditors, why shouldn't that get to a further developed stage of the pleadings than where this case got thrown out?
Well, because it is the obligation of a plaintiff to state a cause of action. And I don't believe that our law yet provides for fiduciary duties to creditors, direct fiduciary duties to creditors that allow creditors to require the directors to act for their benefit, for their exclusive benefit. And what I would like to do is to say where the law stands. I mean, here's where I think it stands. Directors have an obligation to maximize the value of the firm for the benefit of all those who have an interest in it. That is the object of their business judgment. Obviously, creditors will have limited claims on corporate assets, claims limited by their contracts, for the most part. But they are able to protect themselves through contract, through other legal doctrine. And therefore, I don't think there can be a direct fiduciary duty to a creditor. I think the Vice Chancellor was correct in throwing this case out at the pleading stage because I don't think the cause of action alleged exists. I said at the outset, and if I can end on this note, that recognizing broad fiduciary duties to creditors and allowing direct creditor fiduciary claims would damage the fabric, the credibility, and utility of our law. The fabric of our law is woven from 100 years of enforcing director fealty to the firm and to the stockholders. It would damage the credibility of our law to make sudden and radical shifts to bring in direct claims of fiduciary duty for creditors.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
I'm sorry. I just want to throw in this point that the federal courts have predicted that this court would recognize the zone of insolvency, have they not, the Third Circuit?
I believe that what the federal courts have recognized is that directors may take in the zone of insolvency may take the interests of creditors into account in making their business decisions. I don't believe that the Third Circuit or any other federal court has concluded that or has held that there is a direct fiduciary duty owing to the creditors in the zone of insolvency. I think it would damage the utility of our law as well. And so the court below reached the right result, and the dismissal that the court below entered should be affirmed. Thank you.
Couple of quick points. I don't mean to be glib, but listening to Mr. Nolan, you would think this case had been tried and not dismissed at the pleading stage. The facts are that the court below found we made a prima facie proof of insolvency. That's a fact determination. You can't set that aside. Now, with respect to the point about whether or not NACET was a creditor, of course, the complaint squarely says it's a substantial creditor. That's a direct quote. It also says, in any fair reading of this complaint, that NACET was entitled to be paid for its license rights, that Clearwire was running out of money and ran out of money, that Clearwire had not paid NACET, that Clearwire had instilled, said, we have the rights to these licenses, but we're not going to pay you. All that's in the complaint. Now, to say that it doesn't say NACET is a creditor, it seems to me, does great violence to the very words of the complaint, and is certainly not a fair reading of the complaint. Now, I do want to spend a moment on this parade of horribles, that if somehow this court recognizes that there's some duty running to creditors upon insolvency, that Delaware law is going to fall apart. Now, as we said in our brief, we recognize the business judgment rule applies to directors of an insolvent corporation. No one has argued to the contrary. We also said, and the complaint says it out in detail, that this is a conflict situation. This isn't a bunch of directors who are acting in a disinterested fashion. As the complaint alleges, it's a bunch of directors who are preferring another creditor, Goldman Sachs, their employer. This is not, therefore, a case where, and nothing this court's going to say, in this case, nothing the lower court said, is in any way outside of our normal Delaware law with respect to the duties of directors. Certainly, in a conflict situation, all we say is the directors have to take into account the circumstances and proceed accordingly in accordance with our regular law. So there isn't any parade of horribles that's going to occur here if you recognize that under the right circumstances, directors have a duty to creditors upon insolvency. Now, nothing my friend has said, I think, really addresses that point. Instead, he acts as if you at all recognize this duty, that the law will come to, our law will be permit all kinds of conflicts of directors. I mean, as we said in our brief, there are dozens of decisions that have dealt with directors in this conflict situation, upheld their actions.
Can your complaint be phrased in a way that if the directors had behaved in the manner which you think they should have, that they would have maximized the value of the firm by doing that? Or is it all just money going from someone to your client?
The complaint could have been phrased that the directors acted in the way we say they should have acted, that they would have maximized the value to Clearwire by not causing it to go into incredible increased debt. They would have, for example, in the year 2001, after the master agreement came out, was signed, Clearwire bought some of these license rights and paid NACET. When it ran out of money, the appropriate thing to do was to say, as to these license rights that are now available, we don't want those. Even though we are obligated to buy them, we don't want them because we don't have any money. Now, that doesn't mean we're going to cancel the master agreement. But as of today, we can't pay you. We're not going to incur this huge debt. Sell it to somebody else. And as the complaint alleges, there were buyers. So what would have happened is that NACET would have taken these licenses, sold it to somebody else, thereby mitigated its damage claim against Clearwire, and we wouldn't be here. If it's someday Clearwire ever had any money, then it could exercise its rights with respect to those licenses that came up for availability at that time.
Could you explain again why, assuming there is a cause of action here, it's direct and not derivative?
I think the cause of action here is direct because the harm that occurred in asserting a claim to a NACET license harmed only NACET. That did not harm Clearwire because Clearwire didn't have to pay any money under these circumstances. This is a case where Clearwire was paying money out. In fact, had they acted properly, Clearwire would not have had the contractual debt that it now has to NACET for failure to pay the money that was due. Only NACET was hurt by this claim to those license rights because only it was NACET's license rights they couldn't sell. Then, of course, in 2002 with WorldCom, the market cratered for these license rights. So who was left holding the bag? NACET.
Certainly Clearwire wasn't hurt by what they did. So I don't know how Clearwire, a stockholder of Clearwire, the only claim a stockholder of Clearwire could possibly make in this situation is that we're suing you directors because you acted so badly to NACEP that you caused Clearwire to cause unnecessary liabilities. You should have disclaimed these licenses and not incurred that liability. But that's not our claim. That's a stockholder claim. Our claim is my licenses were taken, and therefore I'm entitled to assert these duties against these directors because they acted improperly in a conflict situation. I hope I've tried to answer your question. I know I've tried. I hope I have. Let's put it that way. Your Honor, unless you have some other questions, those are the points I wanted to make.
Thank you, Mr. McNally.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for that interesting and entertaining argument. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.